Before this shadow process got involved, it used to be, I might not like what you have to say, but I will defend to the death your right to say it. Now it's like, if you don't agree with my ideology, you deserve to die. You deserve to be canceled. This shadow dynamic in our society, which is moved to the most extreme ideology, is being fueled by the underlying process shadow of whoever does the most extreme trauma drama gets the media attention, gets the most likes and the most interaction. And so that process shadow is actually driving our society further and further apart.
Welcome to Salish Wolf, a podcast bringing you inspirational stories of extraordinary endeavors. I am your host, Todd Howard. Just south of my Vancouver Island home is a tiny archipelago on which for nearly a decade lived a most astonishing animal, a lone wolf. Takea, as he would be named, survived and thrived in an environment where likely no wolf had ever set foot. In the process, he captured the hearts of a community and showed us even the most unlikely is possible. His story is not dissimilar to those of the individuals interviewed on this podcast. At some point, they each had to turn to their inner lone wolf. From there, they were able to lead and inspire. My intention is to share their journeys to help you discover your own inner greatness and peace. This podcast is brought to you by Anchor Point Expeditions, where I provide life-changing personal leadership retreats for men, coaching, and other valuable personal growth resources. Visit anchorpointexpeditions.com to see where your journey could take you. In this episode, Kim Barta casts light on some of our most hidden aspects, our shadows. Kim is an internationally recognized psychotherapist, coach, and spiritual guide with extensive experience in shadow work and spectacular results in his psychotherapy practice. During this conversation, Kim defines what shadows are and indicates that the risk of not recognizing and integrating them is not fully fulfilling our destiny. He supports this concept with clear examples of how shadows can continually sabotage our journey through life. Meanwhile, they also provide beautiful opportunities for growth and healing when we choose to steer our journey through them. Kim highlights how shadows impact society and cultures, especially our projection onto others of our inborn shadows. We see the ill effects of projection in all areas of life, including politics, media, and right at home in our families. The collective familial trauma that we choose to carry forward by not assimilating our shadows perpetuates those traumas and sadly breeds new ones. When we align our identities with the darkness in our cultural history, we block out the light and cast the next generation in shadows. Kim's unique background has deep spiritual roots, including a reverence for shamanism. He not only lived with a Native American shaman, but also did his master's thesis on shamanism in modern psychotherapy and continues to use aspects of it in his clinical practice. Alongside his sister, Dr. Terry O'Fallon, Kim presents workshops and trainings at Stages International, the platform they co-created to offer training and resources informed by the Stages model of human development developed by Dr. O'Fallon. Be prepared to explore deeply the potential light hidden in the dark in this episode of Salish Wolf with Kim Barta. Salish Wolf episodes highlight the power of the human spirit, the ultimate testing ground of which seems to be adversity. The hardships that make us human, remarkable humans, often involve trauma and grief. As isolating and crippling as they can be, you are not alone in your journey with them, and you do not have to be alone in your journey through them. My wife, Bree Sager, is a certified grief recovery specialist and provides online, group-based programs for individuals ready to explore their healing potential. Grief is emotional, not logical, and she uses her intuition, training, and experience to guide you into your heart to find true healing. This work with her is deeply transformative and profoundly liberating. To learn more, visit beyondgrief.ca/individuals. Her next multi-week programs begin in the first half of September and are extremely limited in spaces. Pause for a moment, tune into your heart, and listen if this opportunity feels right. If it does, apply to the Beyond Grief Grief Recovery Program and take the next step in your healing journey. And now, on with the show. Kim, welcome to Salish Wolf.
Thank you, Todd. Thanks for having me on here with you. I'm excited to have our conversation.
Yeah, it should be great. I want to first acknowledge Lonnie Jarrett, who I know has been a student of yours in the past. He's a past guest of mine on the podcast and a friend. And I was actually interviewing him last year when he mentioned he was just about to start one of your courses on shadow work, I believe. Mm-hmm. And I didn't jump on it quick enough when he said it in the interview. I only kind of heard it properly when I was doing the edits. And by that point, your course had already started because it's something that I was really excited about, but I just kind of missed it. So anyway, wanted to reach out and see if you could come on to the show. I'm grateful that you can. How about we start with that work that you're doing with shadows? Can you tell us a bit about what that is?
Yeah, so shadow work, of course, is our hidden self, the part of ourselves that we don't know. There's a part of ourselves that we know, we see, we understand, and there's a part of ourselves that we don't see. You know, others might see it, we don't see it, and there's even a part of ourselves that others don't see and we don't see. So shadow, it's really taking the unconscious part of ourselves and making it conscious. And so this shadow program that I'm doing not only helps teach shadow, the hidden self, helps us discover it in different ways, but it also then does this beautiful group work process with it so that you get to work together with other people that are really doing the deep dive into the inner being of who we are. And by working together in a team, you know, we get to discover ourselves on deeper levels and solve a lot of problems. The hidden self, the shadow self, of course, has many beautiful aspects to it. Sometimes we have these beautiful parts of ourselves that we don't even know we have. We don't realize it. Other people might see it, or nobody even sees it. We discover it over time. And then sometimes it has these very difficult aspects to it. For example, have you ever tried to accomplish something, like you have a goal, like you're going on a diet or you want to accomplish something really good, and then all of a sudden you find yourself sabotaging yourself? It's like, how did that happen? How did I, you know, undermine my whole plan here? And that's part of this hidden self too. It's like these hidden aspects of consciousness inside that have different agendas than our conscious mind has. And by getting to know these inner parts of ourselves, we can actually bring ourselves into a place of more peace and alignment that that helps our life unfold in a much more smooth and enjoyable way.
So are shadows then neither positive nor negative? They could be either?
Yes, it can be either. Sometimes, like when we grow up, it's like, take a look at how when we grow up, sometimes it's like, oh, don't stand out. Don't be arrogant. Don't be selfish. Don't brag, things like that. Those are all good messages in a way, but what sometimes that does is it teaches us to kind of shrink ourselves. And then these beautiful parts of ourselves, we tend to try to deny in ourselves. And then those beautiful selves come out in all these ways, but we don't see it ourselves because we've been told so much, you know, don't be, you know, don't shine so much, you know, don't stand out. And so we hide that part from ourselves, but it's still in there, these beautiful parts of ourselves. So that's where we talk about dark shadow and golden shadow. The golden shadow is the part that is beautiful in us that we kind of suppress. And the dark shadow is the stuff that is maybe, you know, a little bit not so nice in us that we also suppress, but by not seeing it, we can't deal with it then. And so our shine doesn't get to shine so bright, and our hidden part that is maybe self-destructive or destructive to others is also hidden. And so we can't really manage it in a skillful way.
So in that example you just gave, it sounded to me that like this is the shadow is something that is formed through nurturing versus through nature. Is there part of the shadow that we can inherit from our familial lineage, or is it all post-birth traumas and just the environment that we are raised in that causes that?
That's a really good question. You know, depending upon how classic you look at it or how open you look at it, like we know, for example, that good parenting, like we've taken rat studies, for example, and taking a really good parent rat, a mother rat that's just really a good mother, and then separated the rats, you know, the things that people do to animals and other human beings is pretty amazing, but we can learn from it at least. And we can trace good parenting up to 15 generations in rats, even though they were not raised by that mother. So the mother was a really good mother. We know that it's a good mother. And then the next batch of pups, we take and they've taken them away and had them raised without that mother. And we can trace good mothering up to 15 generations in rats. And also trauma can sometimes also pass down multiple generations. So we can see that we can have multi-generational beauty and multi-generational trauma. And then being able to work with that then is, it's a process of bringing that into the conscious and working with that in a way so that we can reconfigure our consciousness in a way that is healthy and shines for us rather than carries on this multi-generational trauma work. And I don't know if you know, but I worked on the Native American reservation for 30 years where I deal with chronic, long-term, multi-generational trauma. And I can let you know that we can do that healing work. You know, you're not assigned to it forever, but there are some dynamics that can be coded, like starvation experiences, where like we know that people that were subject to starvation in World War II in the Scandinavian countries, for example, and what that does is it leads to more fat accumulation. That fat stores better in terms of starvation than muscle. And so what happens is there's multi-generation of, even if people exercise and eat healthy and stuff, that they tend to gain weight a lot more because that multi-generational coding is there to make sure that you survive. And so sometimes when people go on diets, there's people that exercise, they do everything right, but their DNA, RNA complex sets them up for more fat storage versus more muscle storage.
So if it's both nurture and nature, I'm wondering if someone has a good genetic lineage and then they come into this world and they have a terrible upbringing, if that lineage can maybe be strong enough that they can overcome that upbringing and still end up developing into a somewhat balanced human being. Because naturally we see that. We see people who grow up in environments where it's like, how did you even manage to survive, mm-hmm. let alone be the beautiful person that you are? Mm-hmm. Could that, is there anything potentially genetically that's coming through and supporting them? Or is it just other factors that are at play and they just manage to get through that?
That's a really good question, Todd. And I'm not sure how much we know on that from a scientific perspective. It does seem to be that way, that there's genetic predispositions for resilience and things like that. But we can also train that in. We can help people learn that. We can help people become more resilient. There's multiple things we want to look at. Is resilience is the ability to resist trauma being embedded into us, you know. Resilience is that capacity, but there's also recovery. We might have a stressor that really knocks us down, and we want to be able to recover back to our full capabilities. And how much time does it take to recover, and how fully can we recover? So for example, you know, people that have trauma after trauma after trauma, might have resilience and then crash, right? Or they might crash and then recover back to their full capacities. Or they might crash and recover 80% and the next one knocks them down and they recover another 80%. And over the course of multiple traumas, you're functioning at a very low capacity. You're just overwhelmed by these trauma after trauma, these stressors after stressors. And what we want to do is build not only resilience, but recovery capacities.
Is there a type of shadow that tends to be more challenging to work with? I.e., would it be the inherited traumas, or would it be the traumas just in this lifetime?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think multi-generational trauma, we have studied that to some degree. And part of what makes a multi-generational trauma harder for the next generation is when the parents keep reciting the trauma and ingrain it and entrain it into the next generation. We are the traumatized people. We are that, right? And so an identity gets built up in the child about being part of a multi-generational trauma lineage. And other parents say, hey, yes, we went through trauma, but we're resilient. We recover. We're, you know, they send a different message. And we can, and we see that families that don't identify as a traumatized group do so much better, and the generations beyond them do so much better. So you can take like World War II Jewish families that really talk about the trauma and talk about how we're a multi-generational trauma experience. And those kids tend to do a lot less well than the families that don't identify that way, that identify on the resilience side. We see that in Native American, we see that in Black slave descendants. If you identify with the trauma, it's so much harder for the next generation than if you identify as we are rising up, we're strong, we can recover.
I think that's so important, identifying with the culture as opposed to identifying with the trauma that has affected the culture.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
One has a very negative outcome and the other one likely a very positive.
Yeah.
In the example that you just gave, where there is this identity, a familial identity with a trauma, and then someone carries that into their personal identity, is that then the shadow if it's something that they are conscious of? Mm. Or is it something else?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because technically shadow is that which is unconscious. But there are multiple layers to what we mean by the unconscious. So a lot of people say, hey, if shadow's the unconscious and you make it conscious, now you don't have shadow anymore. Well, that's got some truth to it, but it also has, it's a simplified understanding of what shadow is, because I can make it conscious that my family interprets our family lineage through trauma, and therefore now that that's conscious, it's no longer affecting me. But there's so many subtle messaging along the way, you know, that is still unconscious. So even though I get the big thing conscious, I have the unconscious mini messages along the way. And I also have the unconscious entrainment in my body, the body memory of being raised that way. So just because my linguistic mind can say it doesn't mean I have the conscious understanding of the micro tensions that are held in my body as a result of being raised that way. So what we want to do when we're working with shadow is not only clear up the linguistic mind, but we need to clear up the somatic. We need to clear up the visual dynamics, all the sensorial dynamics, the linguistic, the auditory, the visual, the kinesthetic, all of those are encoding this in our being in multiple different ways. And this is one of the things that a lot of people come to me and they say, gosh, I've been through trauma work, and I've gone through shadow work, but why does this still haunt me? And what I do is I go down through all the sensory modalities. And sure enough, you know, the shadow worker did really good work with the linguistic brain, but they didn't do any work with the somatic, for example, or they did good somatic work, but they didn't deal with the linguistic, or they did the somatic and the linguistic, but they didn't deal with the visuals. And so what you need to do is realize that when we encode shadow and trauma in our being, that is encoded through multiple sensory modalities. And we need to work with every one of those sensory modalities or the ones that are affected. Not necessarily all of them are affected, but the ones that are affected, we need to be able to map that out and see how they're affected and then release that.
I really want to go into that. I want to learn how you do that and the type of work that you do. Before we do that, I just had one more question, I think, which is, what is the risk of not identifying and resolving shadows?
Well, the risk is that we don't live the full vivacious life that we're capable of. What happens is we don't get to, we have those sabotaging things where we self-sabotage in microscopic ways and in massive ways. We have perhaps addictions that keep haunting us. We have the golden shadow that could shine. We might have an inner artist or an inner author in us, or all kinds of beautiful skills and capabilities, but we just don't see them. So we never get to fulfill ourselves as fully as we could, both from the light side and from the self-sabotage side. And so that's what happens when we don't get to, when we still have multiple shadows operating within us. It limits us on both those dynamics.
So from a Taoist perspective of, we are here to fulfill our destiny, if we're not identifying and bringing those shadows into the conscious and working through resolving them, we can't fulfill our destiny. We can't live our true life's purpose.
Yeah, or we live it only in a limited perspective, in a limited way. We don't get to really live the full vivacious dynamic aspect of it.
Right. Okay, take us please into the type of work, the somatic and the sensorial work that you do, and how on each of those levels you're able to work with the shadow to integrate it.
Yeah, so this is a pretty intensive course if you were to actually take the training, but I can give you a few examples. So for example, from a shamanic perspective, what I do, because I do what I did in my undergraduate, I combined shamanism and modern psychotherapy and brought them together for my thesis. And what we do from modern psychotherapy is different than what we do from a shamanic perspective. And from a shamanic perspective, what we do is we go in and allow, we have a flexibility of consciousness to go in when we're working with somebody and take the shape of the same consciousness as the person we're working in. We become that being, that shape of consciousness. And then from that shape of consciousness, intimately knowing it, we understand health and we understand the distorted shape of that consciousness, and we systematically bring ourselves to a place of health in relationship with the person that we're with. And from a psychology perspective, what we do is we assess the dynamic of the person, and then we create a pathway to health. And there are multiple styles of doing that. So what we want to do is I combine both the Western wisdoms and the shamanic wisdoms and shamanism from around the world, not just Native American shamanism, but shamanism from around the world, and do this. So one of the things we do then is we enter into that consciousness, and we can feel then the shape of how the consciousness is distorted. So I listen to the person very deeply, feel the somatic constrictions that would occur from holding that shape of consciousness. I explore the visual dynamics that they have. What are the visions in their mind when they start talking about a particular issue? What is the language structure that they're using? What is the sounds or the auditory experiences beyond the linguistic that they're experiencing? What are the smells or tastes that come up when they're going through this? What is the sense of balance or the proprioception dynamics? Some people even have a magnetic sense. People can actually, there are certain people that you can close their eyes and turn them around a little bit and say point north, and they can point north. And some of these people can have a magnetic sense in the shadow as well as the beauty. So what you want to do is be able to really notice how the trauma or the shadow is affecting every one of these sensorial dynamics, and then bring these dynamics, free them up to health. And there are three basic distortions in any shadow work that could occur. We have interjects, we have projections, and we have split ego states. And you have to work completely different with each one of those. And that's one of the problems that occurs, especially in a lot of shadow work today, is people learn a shadow work technique and they apply that all the time. It's like, oh, I learned a shadow work technique and I'm going to use that with everybody that comes into me with shadow. But the problem is you can cause a lot of damage by just using a single form of shadow work technique. Because if I have an introject, that means that I've absorbed information that's not me into me. This happens a lot with, say, someone who's been traumatized by somebody, they've been beaten up, they've been raped or something like that. And what they do is part of that perpetrator energy, for lack of a better word, gets absorbed inside of them because they are helpless, they're victims. So the intrusion comes into them and they actually absorb some of that consciousness of the abuser. That is an introject. And what we want to do is release that. We want to release that out. And there's techniques that I use to help release, but there's release techniques, okay? But then there are also ways that we project out onto the world. We project a distortion of our own perception of the world out onto the world. And then we have a lot of anger, resentment, frustration, disgust, all of that tends to be from a projection oriented shadow. And what we need to do to heal that is we need to bring that back in. Otherwise, every time we live in anger, resentment, disgust, frustration, we're leaking our vital energy out into the world. And what we want to do is recapture that energy and make it healthy so that we live a vital, full, vital, rich life. And then we have split ego states. If we get traumatized, sometimes our consciousness gets torn apart. The part that gets traumatized gets hidden away, and the part that's conscious goes on and lives. And this is where we get that self-sabotage that occurs. So what we're doing is we're moving along with our conscious self, and the part that we put into the unconscious says, wait a minute, you've been ignoring me for too long. I need to come out. And we keep shoving that down because we're not comfortable with it. And then when it comes out in very self-sabotaging ways. So everything that we thought we were accomplishing gets undermined by this self-sabotaging part. Well, you can imagine that if I use a technique, a release technique for introject, but I'm actually dealing with a projection, what I'm going to do is actually augment the projection. If I use a re-owning technique like that I use with projection, where I pull my energy back in, but I do that with an introject, I'm actually absorbing more of that perpetrator energy in me that's not really a part of me in the first place. I'm re-owning it too much, and I'm solidifying it inside of me. And with split ego states, what we want to do is have an integration technique. So again, if I integrate like that perpetrator energy in me, I think that I need to integrate all shadow. That's what a lot of people do. They go, oh, anything that's inside, we need to integrate it. But if I integrate that perpetrator shadow energy in me, I actually solidify and anchor that shadow more deeply in me. So what I need to do is have the wisdom to understand that there are three broad classes of shadow, and I need to identify them accurately, and I need to then use the appropriate healing technique with each one. Otherwise, it can actually cause more damage to my client if I don't get that accurate.
Okay. I'm going to bring up a fairly contentious concept just as an example and see if we can work through this.
Mm-hmm.
Racism. Today, it is something that we hear a lot about. I think a lot of people, when we look at the shadow, are onboarding that. That'd be the interjecting shadow, because society is saying, you are racist if you don't do this, this, or this, or you are racist if you're complicit if you're not standing up for this. And I think there are a lot of people who are just taking that on and going, oh, gee, I must be racist. Then I see a lot of people, and maybe those same people, who are then projecting that outward. You're racist because you're complicit in all of this. So they're projecting, which therefore means, I think anyway, since that's what they're focusing on, that's what they're going to receive back. That's what they're going to find. Because when they focus that energy out into the world on racism, well, they're going to find it. And then I'm wondering if that also then kind of becomes part of this split ego, where someone's like, oh, I see it out there, and I know people are telling me I am this, but I don't really feel like I'm this. And yet, I think that person is, but now I'm all confused. So I'm wondering if that example basically bridges all three of these shadow types, the interject, the projection, and the split ego, and how then that could be worked with and resolved. And it doesn't have to be this example. It could be anything, but this is just something that I see a lot going on.
Yeah, no, that's a real vital thing that's happening in our society and has been happening for hundreds of years, ever since the birth of the United States, for example. And so from the one side, you know, say you are a black slave that in the 1800s, right? You received, interjected in, you know, the interject of the slave masters who made you feel less than human, right? And many, many slaves then interjected that, felt less than human. And then they projected that out on other blacks, and saw the whole white black superiority, inferiority thing. And then there's the part of them that said, no, wait, I'm a human. So you have to interject the projection and the split ego state all occurring. And then in modern society, we see this happening. I mean, one of the places where I see it happening now, not only the continuation of that, but now I get a lot of really, especially young white males who feel really guilty, like they are responsible for all the trauma of all of human history. You know, it's being really projected onto white males, and especially the young white males who don't have a solid identity yet, are really absorbing all the colonial guilt of the last several hundred years, that it's their fault, their responsibility, even though they never participated in it, even though they don't believe it. They've been raised to be, you know, absolutely supportive of all races, all classes, you know, all these dynamics. And they're very, very sensitive, very caring, very loving young white males. And as a result of being very sensitive, caring, they're the ones that are absorbing this entire history of colonial guilt upon them. Whereas the white males that are not so sensitive or caring, they're the ones that are saying, this is a bunch of baloney, I'm not going to carry that at all. So actually the very white males that would be allies are the ones that are absorbing the huge amount of interjection of the guilt of that. And this is not theirs to carry. You know, they didn't participate in it. They are just innocent young white males that have done nothing but try to be sensitive and caring and loving and supportive and inclusive. And they're carrying this incredible amount of multi-generational guilt that's being projected onto them. They're interjecting it. And then some are struggling with, wait a minute, I'm a good person. You know, why? You know, there's this struggle between, wait a minute, I'm a good person, but I'm also fully responsible for all of that history. And so you get the split ego state. So you get the interjection, the projection, the split ego state, all creating this complex dynamic that keeps a human being from being vitally alive. So you can see how the history of that projection onto the historic black slaves is now creating this multi-generational meta-dynamic where these projections and split ego states and interjections are all creating this multi-systemic dynamic of interjections, projections, and split ego states across the races, across time, across generations.
And I'm going to add a little bit more complexity to this too. What if we take out the actual racism, true racism factor, and we just work with this societal concept of historical racism, even though maybe let's just pretend it's not there, but can we still create these same traumas and wounds by the projections of racism? Because people are taking on the interject shadow of feeling like they need to be aware of racism. They need to call people out on it. So then they're projecting it. Other people are onboarding that. Everyone's got this split ego. When we distill it down, maybe the original sin, so to speak, isn't even there in the first place. It's just all been perpetuated by society and by narrative and by media and the world that we live in today. Is that a possibility? And I'm not saying racism doesn't exist, but I'm just saying as an example that the perpetuation of it is far worse than the actual thing itself as far as damage done.
So when we take a look at just taking it out of racism for a moment, if we take a look at how shadow works, let's say I was traumatized as a child, right? And then I grow up through that trauma and I have these different shadow dynamics, I interject split ego states. What happens is even if the perpetrator, say it was a parent, changes, becomes a very healthy, dynamic, supportive human being, I can still carry that trauma because I haven't done my shadow work. And so I can keep, even though my parents making the change, I see them as being this awful person because of the history that I carry inside by the shape of my consciousness. So yes, even though an external dynamic may have changed completely, I still carry it because I haven't done my consciousness work. I haven't cleared up my piece. And until I do, I will tend to continue to project upon that parent that they're a bad person, that they are different than they are in the here and now moment. And that will lead to relationship shadow dynamics that keep occurring. I will treat them as if they're still that way. And after being treated that way over and over and over, and even though they changed, if I tend to treat a person a certain way, sometimes they tend to respond that way. They can only hold so much stressor, right? Before they respond in a way that they're being treated. If I treat you as less than, and I keep treating you as less than over and over and over, you know, at some point you're going to resent that and you're going to react to it. And then I'm going to go, see there, proof, right? And so we actually, through our projection process onto the world, we actually stimulate the very trauma that otherwise would not have occurred. And so that can happen on massive levels, from racism to sexism to classism to Democrats and Republicans. This happens a lot in the left-right split. The right projects onto the left that they're a certain way. And after being treated that way long enough, there's some kind of a reaction and they go, proof, see there, you know, and the left projects onto the right a certain way. And after a while, the right reacts in a certain way. They go, proof, see there. But there's these beautiful people on both the left and the right that are not reacting, that are really able to listen and care for each other, that can cross the political divide without hate, resentment, and projection. But those people don't even get noticed because the trauma drama is what gets the attention. The trauma drama gets the media attention. The trauma drama gets, you know, the blood boiling and everything. And if you want to increase advertising sales, if you want to get more likes on your social media, if you accentuate the trauma drama, that's what's going to get people interacting. And so what we can see is the very nature of how Facebook is designed, the very nature of how our media is designed, Drama gets the attention, and so it gets accentuated. And so that shadow process in our society is actually what's stimulating this increasing divide between the left and the right, to the point that we can't even sit down and have a civil conversation. Before this shadow process got involved, it used to be like the World War II generation. I might not like what you have to say, but I will defend to the death your right to say it. Now it's like, if you don't agree with my ideology, you deserve to die. You deserve to be canceled. You deserve to be eliminated on both the left and the right. And you can see it getting so extreme now that even like members of the same party that aren't on the extreme ideology, they get canceled. Like Liz Cheney's getting canceled by the right because she's not extreme enough, right? Even though she was a standard Republican style of Republican congressperson, you know, up until the last few years. So, and you see it happening on the left as well. So this shadow dynamic in our society, which is moved to the most extreme ideology, is being fueled by the underlying process shadow of whoever does the most extreme trauma drama gets the media attention, gets the most likes and the most interaction on Facebook, gets the most interactions on Twitter. And so that process shadow is actually driving our society further and further apart. And we can take that and name any topic and pour it into that pattern. And you can just see how everything's being torn apart by that shadow process. So that's the difference between shadow content and shadow process. A lot of times people heal shadow content, but they don't heal the shadow process. And so the shadow process, you pour any content into it, it just drives another shadow. It doesn't matter what content you pour into it. You know, sure, I healed whatever the dynamic is on one level, you know, maybe I heal my classism, but now I pour sex into it and I spur the sexism, or I pour race into it and I spur the division and racism. I pour, you know, anything into it, you know, and it just spurs that continual split because the process shadow is still there. That happens on a huge cultural level and it happens on an individual level.
Oh, there's so much there, Kim. Wow. So basically, we get what we focus on. And so when we're focused on the trauma drama, like that's when we build our life around that and we're projecting it outwards, then we're going to get that same energy back, which is a chaotic, reckless, pathogen causing trauma. Basically, we are rendering ourselves ill by focusing on that.
Yeah.
So with this shadow content versus shadow process, that's really cool stuff. So what you're saying is, what I think you're saying is that someone can become aware of a shadow that they have, and they can, at least on one level, work through that to try to distill it down to the point where they integrate it. But if they still have that shadow process tendency, then they'll just onboard something else and plug and play into that, and kind of a new shadow comes out of that. So can you just elaborate a bit on how that works, what that shadow process is? Is that what just comes to mind for me right now is that's the victimhood process. That's the state of being a victim. But is that kind of the essence of it, or is there far more to it than that?
That would be one example of a shadow process. I am a victim. Okay. Now what I might do is have the content of, I was, you know, beaten by my father. So I cure that whole thing. I can interact with my father. I'm doing fine. But I haven't cured the shadow process, which is I get some vicarious benefit out of being a victim, okay? Or I get my identity fulfilled by being a victim. So now, even though I'm doing good with my dad, maybe I have an interaction with a neighbor and I feel victimized by them. And that's a whole dynamic. Let's say I even heal that one. Now I feel victimized by the government, or I feel victimized by white people or by black people or by males or by females, or I continually regenerate a victim experience with a friend, with a neighbor, with on a personal level or on a whole societal level. It depends upon how much we generalize. So that's a whole nother dynamic, generalization versus specification. So what happens is, for example, let's say I'm being raised by an abusive parent. And what happens is I'm a child, I'm developing my authentic identity, I get shut down. And then I confront my parent by being mean and I get even more compression. Okay, as a child, I can't survive that. So where does that energy go? That energy of that introject of being oppressed and suppressed, it has to leak out somewhere. It often leaks out somewhere. And that's where we get our projections onto society. So all this trauma that's being shoved into me as a child, and I can't get it directly back to the original source, it leaks out onto other sources. So it leaks out on the government. It leaks out onto the left. It leaks out onto the right. It leaks out onto blacks. It leaks out on whites. It leaks out onto men. It leaks out onto women. It leaks out onto an older generation or a younger generation. It leaks out. And I don't even remember the original issue because that is so buried deep. I cannot just direct it back to the original source of where that trauma came from. So now I've got this process dynamic going on that just keeps leaking out. So my tendency is to project my anger or my fear onto general society. So now we can get into, okay, let's just take anger, fear, and low self-esteem. Okay. If I take my anger, now all of a sudden I'm angry about the entire movement on the left, or I'm angry about the entire movement on the right, or I'm angry about the federal government, or I'm angry about all these classes of people. Since I can't do it to the specific, it leaks out onto others. And sometimes I generalize it to larger and larger groups of people until my anger is just spewing out on all kinds of people. Or my fear, I start getting paranoid about this or that, or conspiracy theories, right? It just gets leaked out onto larger and larger fields. And not saying that some conspiracy theories aren't real, because we know some are, we've got them documented, but there's a difference between assessing an actual conspiracy and just spewing conspiracy everywhere, right? Out of our fear, the fear process dynamic, or the low self-esteem process dynamic, where I make myself smaller in front of people, or I even become susceptible to cults because I need someone else to be the wise, strong person, because I am continuing the process of I am less than, or the other end, I have to be greater than, better than everybody else. So I leak out my narcissism on everyone. I try to control and manipulate and everything like that. So there's a lot of different process dynamics.
And with any shadow, is there always content and the process associated mm-hmm. with it?
Yes, there's always a content and a process. And a lot of times what happens is, we work with the content. We go, oh, look, we healed the person. We did so great. They feel so much better. But we never touch the underlying process dynamic. And it just keeps regenerating shadow after shadow after shadow.
And then that can lead to this historical familial shadow that we were talking mm-hmm. about earlier. Mm-hmm. Someone thinks they're doing the work. They work through the content. They resolve their mommy or daddy wounds, at least on the surface, but if the process is still there, then they're probably perpetuating that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Wow. So we see that by the process of, like we said earlier, a traumatized culture, like the Jewish culture in World War II, when they might, for example, become very successful and create a great successful life. But the process dynamic is we are a victimized people. And so that gets passed down from generation to generation. And that trauma keeps making the people feel, even though they can be very successful in many ways, they can feel very awful internally. And instead of being able to feel the full vivacious aliveness of their incredible success and resilience, even though on an objective level, the resilience and the recovery is there, the subjective experience is not there because the process shadow continues.
This actually reminds me of the conversation I had with Lonnie Jarrett, because we talked a lot about the Taoist concept of naming, Ming Ming, mm-hmm. to give a thing a destiny by giving it a name. Mm-hmm. And the more we label, the more we divide. And of course, the more we divide, I think then the more we create the environment where these shadows can come out and have repercussions mm-hmm. on people. And as you're saying, if we focus on the left and the right, us versus them, black versus white, whatever it is, as opposed to focusing on what makes us the same, mm-hmm. what unifies us, then basically we are perpetuating a shadow culture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So how content versus process shadow works. So for example, you see the left and the right divide, right? So what happens is the left can point to the right and say, you are doing X, Y, Z. You know, we are nothing like you. We don't do that. And you know, your policy should not be enacted. And the right looks at the left and says, you behave in this way. You believe in these things. You are so awful, and we should make sure that your policies don't get elected, right? Well, the content is different. So they can continue to see the divide and really point to how the content is so different. But the process is the same. They're both finger pointing, name calling, belittling, degrading, treating each other as less than human. They're behaving exactly the same. And the level of hate and anger and resentment and rejection is the same. So the process shadow is exactly the same. The content is completely different. And that's what allows them to stay focused on the content and justify the continuation of the process shadow. So what I encourage people to do is look at, how do you treat your enemy? And are you treating your enemy the same way that your enemy is treating you? And that gets us to our process shadow. If we stay with content, we can avoid that, right? We can really justify the way we treat somebody else, the way we talk to them on Facebook, or the way we talk about them on Facebook. But then we start looking at our process. Oh, look at the way that I talk about another human being. I'm actually talking the same way that they talk. Mm-hmm. I'm actually exactly like the person that I call my enemy.
And is this where all those different layers and dynamics of shadow work come into to be of assistance, the somatic and the sensorial? Because mm-hmm. if we're just focusing on the content, then maybe we're just stuck in one of those areas. But if we focus mm-hmm. on the process, then we're basically working through all of those. Is that mm-hmm. somewhat accurate?
Yeah, so I often use the description of a tree. So we have the root, and we have the trunk come up, and then the trunk creates all these branches, and the branches take smaller limbs, and then we have leaves, millions of leaves on the tree. And what happens often is we look at one leaf, one shadow leaf on the tree, and go, oh, I got that shadow handled, you know? But if we pluck a leaf off of a tree, it'll just grow another leaf. So now I'm plucking all these shadows off the tree, and the tree just keeps generating new leaves. Now, if I get to a little more of the core piece, I can cut off a whole limb of the shadow tree, but there's other limbs, right? I need to get down to the trunk and ultimately to the root and pull up the shadow tree so that I'm not perpetually generating more and more shadow dynamics. And then that's where I talk about getting to the core seed of the shadow and uprooting it, and then planting a new healthy pattern or process. Instead of a shadow process, I'm planting and nourishing a health process. And that will automatically generate healthy limbs and healthy leaves, and your full vivacious aliveness and passion in the world will come alive. And you will grow and just naturally it will produce more and more health and wonder.
I'm glad you added that last part, and I just want some clarification on that. So as you were talking about uprooting the shadow, I was thinking, okay, but we're then leaving behind this hole, this void. Mm-hmm. Is it then necessary to fill that void with something else? And if we don't fill that void with something else consciously, what might happen?
Yes, if we don't fill that void, and I'm glad you used the term void, because that's a really important piece to get to. If you actually get to the void, you've probably uprooted the core seed, okay? And now we have this void, we have this vast emptiness, which a lot of people are very scared of, to just sit in the emptiness, okay? That can be very uncomfortable for a lot of people. But we pull up the core seed, we sit in the emptiness, and now the question is, what do we do? And what a lot of people do is they feel uncomfortable with the emptiness and they just want to fill it with something. And whatever they fill it with often comes from some residual aspect of some habitual aspect of the core process. And so it doesn't grow a healthy new tree. What we need to do is make peace with the void and sit in that void and make peace with it. And when we do, now the new seed that gets planted by making peace with the void tends to be a much healthier new process. Okay. If I just manufacture something, I will manufacture it from a place of fear of the void.
And is it enough just to sit with it and to find peace in that void and to trust? Is that enough then to create something new and beautiful? Or do we at some point have to take a conscious step to say, okay, I've made peace, but there's still a hole there. I still need to plant something and water it. Or is it just going to come about organically with the right intention of finding peace in what was there that is no longer?
Mm-hmm. And I would say that the healthy way is to let it emerge organically. So for example, if I drop into a void, a sheer emptiness, and I sit and make peace with the emptiness, what will happen is, a good analogy for this is, you ever walk into a room with no windows, but the lights are on, and then you turn off the lights and it's night outside, right?
Okay.
You can't see anything, right?
Right.
But if you sit long enough, all of a sudden you can start making out shapes, right? And you can start seeing a little bit again, right? Yeah. If you sit in the void, you can't see anything because you're used to all the trauma drama, the bright, shiny objects of the trauma drama, right? What happens when those are gone, it's like you're sitting in absolute emptiness and darkness. But if you sit there long enough, the treasures start becoming apparent. The treasures start emerging, the treasures that were inside you all along that were hidden by the trauma drama, shiny objects, okay? Now what happens is, if you sit in there, what'll happen is a couple things will emerge, more shadow and treasure, okay? And whichever one you choose to deal with is fine. You might go, oh, I want to clear more shadow, and you enter into more emptiness, right? Or look at this treasure. I want to notice this treasure and embrace that. And that treasure will grow a new, beautiful, vivacious, passionate plant. Now, we have to be careful about a meta-shadow process here. And that is that not only do we sometimes get to the core seed of the shadow process, but we have another shadow process going on, which is always look for the negative. So now what I do is I ignore that beautiful treasure and I go for the next shadow right away. And it's important to make sure that we take time to nurture the new treasure, plant that seed, let it grow, remember the new shadow that we got to see too. Let this one get flourished and then come back and work with that instead of just always ignoring the treasure. Otherwise, we never get to our passion of vivacious freedom, right? So
this is like the work of inner alchemy, which is taking our darkest, most leaden aspect and turning it into gold. Mm-hmm. What is our greatest weakness with attention and consciousness can become our most powerful strength.
Yeah. Yeah. What we tend to notice will tend to grow. So we notice the shadow and let it grow, but we also can use our noticing to help heal. So we notice the shadow as well. And then we take the healing process. We notice how to heal it. And so we have both the noticing of the treasure and its growth, and we have the noticing of the healing process and the healing process growth.
So you said what we notice will grow. If someone is noticing the void and they're sitting in that, but they have these other shadow processes that always say that the dark is bad, the void is bad, this emptiness is bad, there's just loneliness ahead of you. If they're noticing that, how do we not perpetuate that? How do we break that cycle and get it to be, instead of noticing the negative possibility of aloneness, what if we notice this infinite space of potential now?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
How do we make that switch? How do we turn off the negative and turn to the infinite space of possibility?
Yeah. So we have a couple pieces here. One is, if we have enough comfort with sitting in the emptiness, we will notice the treasure emerge as well as the shadow. If we're not comfortable with it, we'll experience the loneliness, we'll experience, you know, the fear of the loneliness, most likely. And so what I'll do is, as a guide, I'll help them step into that fear and sit with that fear. And we can do several different shadow processes to resolve the fear so that I can be at peace with being alone. And then I'm able to sit in that darkness until I see the treasure emerge.
So is this, in a sense, like the dark night of the soul?
Yes, it can be. It depends. Sometimes, see, the concept of the dark night of the soul has multiple dynamics to it. So I'm hesitant to say this is the dark night of the soul. It can be, depending upon how people define it. Okay. Another dynamic, though, the dark night of the soul is when you move to a new developmental level of consciousness. So what happens is when we move to a new developmental level of consciousness, everything that had meaning in our life suddenly becomes meaningless. And that is often what we call the spiritual dark night of the soul, okay? So what happens is, and we can have this at every developmental level. So I'll give you an example of when we move from 2.5, which is our kind of fundamentalist belief ideology. Like, I believe in my ideology. Doesn't matter what the facts are. Ideology is the ideology. And I believe in my ideology. I believe in my whatever it is, whatever the ideology is. When we step out of that into a true awareness of critical thinking, and we see that the ideology that we've lived our entire life by is an illusion, and that I wasn't willing to really look at honest reality. I filtered reality through my ideology, okay? That ideology falls away. But that's a scary process, because that's what's defined who I am, what my values are, what I'm about, okay? And that is a very frightening process. And all of a sudden, I'm left in this empty space, another type of void, a developmental existential void.
The death versus of the shadow. Ego.
Death of the ego, the ideological ego.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And that goes away. And now I'm sitting in this emptiness, and it's scary. There's nothing to structure my life. I don't know who I am. I don't know what life's about. I don't know how to construct or define values once the ideology is gone. That's an example of the existential dark night of the soul.
It seems to me that this is kind of a case of someone who is doing the work and has reached a point where they have trust in the unfolding of the universe, trust that life is happening for and not happening to, mm-hmm. that individual can then sit in this void in a state of somewhat comfort and knowing. Mm-hmm. the universe has got them, whatever your version of the universe is, whether that's God or whatever else, versus, I'll say, the victim who is stuck in one of these shadow processes and thinks, well, nothing good is going to come out of this. Nothing good can possibly come out of it.
The victim or the controller, we can have either one of those processes going on. I need to control everything, or I'm a victim to everything, right? These are two polarized opposite shadow processes. I'm a victim no matter what happens, or I need to control something no matter what happens. And when we go into that existential dark night of the soul, either one of those processes can come up and create a dark night of the soul. If I'm a victim, it's like, oh my God, I'm going to be victimized here. I have nothing. I don't know how to live a life, and I can feel a victim to it. Or I can go, oh my God, all the controls that I had that made me feel like I was in control, you know, are falling away. And what am I going to do now? Right? This anxiety either way that occurs, the depression or anxiety split. And so when we start trusting the process of life, okay, again, processes versus content, when we drop into trusting a process that we can't see, but we know that it always leads to something better for and fulfilling for us, we actually don't go through a dark night of the soul. We probably go through the dark night of the soul a few times until we trust the process. But now we can start making existential leaps without having to go through the dark night of the soul when we get to the process level.
So it seems then to me that when someone reaches a state of the dark night or this terrible void place of darkness and aloneness, that they're so close to healing because they've uprooted a shadow.
Yes.
And if they can just trust in the process, then healing will be on the other side. But so many of us don't. And so what we end up doing is walking away from that healing opportunity and going in the other direction again.
That's right. Either we get scared because we need to control. We can't control that void. So we fill it with something so we have something to control. Or we're a victim to it and we're scared that we're a victim. So we run away to something that we can see that we're a victim to, rather than an emptiness. So we have no ability to say what I'm a victim to, right? You know, so those two polarized processes in the depth dark night of the soul versus the existential dark night of the soul. Those processes help us run away from it instead of just dropping into trust. You know, that, what is that, that spiritual, that religious orientation of stepping into the void, just trusting stepping into the void. Yeah. Curse through multiple spiritual wisdom traditions.
I think all of them.
At some point, all of them, I'm sure it's universal. At some point, you have to step into the void and just trust it.
Yeah.
You know, trust that you're held.
It's that concept of something has to die for something new to begin.
Mm-hmm.
And the death can sometimes be so painful that people just hang on to it and they end up just getting stuck there.
That's right. Yeah.
One more question on this, and then I kind of want to shift gears for a little bit. Are shadows always caused by trauma?
Well, it depends upon what you mean by trauma. So, they're not always caused by abuse or some traumatic incident. Not at all.
No.
We are raised in a culture, and the culture has shadow within it. Okay.
Yeah.
It has, and we're just swimming in that soup. So we grow up in a society that has a shadow dynamic in it that is just ubiquitous, and nobody even knows that it's there. Like a common one that we have right now that we're starting to play with, but people are very lost by, is the hard link between sex and gender.
Yes.
People are confused between what is sex and what is gender in the first place, but either way, it's hard linked. So what happens is when you realize that sex is our genetic chromosome and gender is the personality process dynamic of who we are, the way we express ourselves in the world. So one is male, female sex, and one is masculine, feminine gender. Okay. Gender is the psychological process of who we are. Sex is the genetic aspect of who we are. But in our society, we hard link sex and gender. So males are masculine, females are feminine. And so we often confuse the terms and we say, we often interchange the terms so that I'm using the term masculine, like I have a male gender. Well, you don't have a male gender, you have a male sex. I have a female gender. You don't have a female gender, you have a female sex. I have a feminine sex. I'm of the feminine sex. No, you have a feminine gender and you have a masculine gender. But these are hard linked. And so what happened in our society, you know, in the last generation is you were born male, so you had to be raised masculine and you had to be a masculine human being. I was born female. I had to be raised feminine. I had to be a feminine human being. And if you take a look at Carl Jung in the 1920s, he said, wait a minute, we need to have the male has a feminine side. So we had the animus and the anima. We have to learn to embrace our feminine side as males, and as females, we need to embrace our masculine side so we can embrace both the masculine and the feminine inside of us. But that's a revolutionary concept because male was masculine, female was feminine, and that was the same. And today we're trying to break that apart, but we're almost swinging the other way so that now if I have a masculine gender, or a feminine gender, I need to make my sex match that. So whereas before we had to break off and destroy half of our gender, I could only be masculine. Now there's almost this other part where if I feel masculine or feminine, I need to change my sex to match that. It's still the same shadow process of hard linking. Now, that's not to say that you can't be transgender, transsexual, all of that. It's just saying that there's a bit of a shadow process still going on where I have to still link them hard. I can't separate and let each one of them flow freely from each other.
Right.
We're working that shadow process out right now, and it's a little bit clumsy in our society.
And recognizing this is a very contentious topic, are we then creating shadows by this new method of raising children to be gender neutral, not identifying them as boys or girls, because there's this belief that that's, you can't do that anymore. You have to let them decide. Mm-hmm. And that to me feels like very dangerous territory.
Yeah, I'm not, I don't think I'm going to step into what is necessarily the healthy way to do it or not. I think what we want to do is allow people to be, like, if you take a look at gender, gender is actually a spectrum. So if you take a look at traditional masculine and feminine, masculine was more of the agentive doing side and feminine was more the receptive being side. And if you take a look at what you brought up before, yin and yang, the Taoism, the masculine is the active agentive side. The feminine is the receptive being side, and how we need to be both masculine and feminine. There's a little bit of feminine in the masculine, a little bit of masculine in the feminine. The yin yang symbol is a very healthy dynamic of understanding that we flow across this dynamic in a little more fluid way than hard linking it as a binary thing. So I think our society is doing a good job at softening the binary aspect of it. But that doesn't necessarily mean being gender neutral. There's a difference between whole gender and gender neutral. So if you take a look at a gender spectrum now, if you see gender as a spectrum rather than a binary thing, it's an entire spectrum. What I can do is I can say I'm on the masculine side of the spectrum, I'm on the feminine side of the spectrum, or I'm in the neutral part of the spectrum, but all three of those are still compressed, right? A whole gender, it allows me to be masculine when I need to be masculine. I can be agentive, and action oriented. I can be feminine, I can be receptive and being oriented. I can be neutral, I can go across that entire spectrum. And so I have a lot more dynamic flexibility in the way that I respond to any given situation in life. instead of always having to come from a dominant, controlling, agentive place, or always from a receptive, learning, receptive being place. Or, oh my God, I have to be in the middle. I can't be masculine or feminine because that's not cool or whatever. I have to always be neutral. All of those are constricted versions of being what could be whole gendered. And to be whole gendered, we need to be able to slide fully masculine for a while and really be masculine to get to know it. And we need to be able to slide to feminine and be fully feminine to get to know it. And we need to be able to be in the middle and get to know that so that we can actually be whole gendered. And that allows a much more dynamic flexibility of our being. But as we do that, we have all these forces in society that are saying, oh, don't be too masculine because that's bad, or don't be too feminine, that's bad. You know, you have to be in the middle. So these constrictions that we have are limiting our full capacity, our full range of being the full human being that we can be.
So much we could talk about. Kim, could you talk just for a little bit about how you came into this work?
The shadow work, the spiritual work.
Yeah, I guess there's so much more to it than just the shadow work. Maybe, all of it, I guess. What is some of the work that you're doing outside of the shadow, and what brought you into this kind of sphere?
Yeah. Of work? Well, depends upon how far we go back from being raised as a child to falling into it almost in an accidental way, or was it all guided? Who knows? But I've always been fascinated by. I was raised in central Montana on a farm and ranch, and despite being on a farm and ranch, I always had an affinity for the Native American. Playing cowboys and Indians, you know, back in the 60s when that was a thing, you know, I always wanted the Indians to win, not the cowboys, which is strange because I was the farm boy and, you know, most people identified with being cowboys at that point. But, you know, I was very unique in that way. I don't know why, but that's what I always wanted. So I always had an affinity for that. And so I explored it more in my college studies. And then, like I said, my master's program was studying shamanism, not just from a Native American perspective, but from around the world, white shamans in the, you know, the Northern European and black shamans in Africa and South American shamans, shamans around the world. And lived with a Native American shaman for a short period of time, you know, and studied and learned from them while going through my master's program, learning psychotherapy, and combined that into a master's program. And my thesis was shamanism as a modern psychotherapeutic technique, where I combined principles of each of those. And then I lived for the last 30 years on a Native American reservation, where I worked with trauma, multi-generational trauma, and all that. So I've lived here and I still live here today. From a certain perspective, everything is secular and everything is spiritual simultaneously. Kind of a Native American orientation is everyday life is a spiritual process, right? So, you know, whether you're doing art, whether you're doing work, whether you're doing this, there's a spiritual dynamic to it. Imbues everything that you do. So you don't go, I'm going to go do my spiritual work now. I'm going to go to a retreat center and do my spiritual work. And now I'm going to go do my, you know, income work. And now I'm going to go be with friends. It's like, no, all of this is an interconnected dynamic. Being fully birthed every moment, right? So that was one aspect. And then my sister, Dr. Terry O'Fallon, developed the stages model, which really is a beautiful developmental process. We've been doing developmental psychology for 100 and some years now, but Terry developed a model that structured it in a new way based upon parameters versus content. And then I worked with her around that a little bit, and we refined that a little bit based upon my grounded, everyday, embedded life experience working with development and babies all the way to people in their 80s and 90s. And working with multi-generational people. I've had five generations of Native American women in my office at the same time.
Wow.
For example. So you get to see, wow, look at how this generational resilience and trauma passed down through five generations, right? So being able to see that kind of expanse all in your room at the same time, noticing what happens, you know, gives you some larger perspectives on what is multi-generational trauma and health, and how does it perpetuate itself, you know? So that with Terry, we've worked things out, and it's really helped me become a lot more precise in understanding trauma and stuff like that. So while I use developmental perspectives to understand trauma and shadow work, by utilizing the stages model, I'm actually able to be much more precise with it. And I'm actually able to pinpoint the developmental stage that a trauma occurs in, the developmental, what parameters are being distorted, parameters of consciousness are being distorted, and I can go and pinpoint the exact parameter and work on that and create a lot more healing in a shorter period of time. Which is something I've been fascinated with, because even before that, when I worked on the Native American reservation here, I was like the only full-time psychotherapist here. There were a couple people doing kind of part-time work, you know, but in my area, I was the only full-time one. And I get all of this trauma coming in. I'm going, if I use standard psychotherapy, it takes 6 months to 6 years to resolve a trauma. I'm not even going to touch what's going on. So I had to start coming up with more and more creative ideas to help resolve it. And I got to the point that I could resolve about 75% of trauma incidences within 1 to 3 sessions instead of 6 months to 6 years. Just
wow, that's incredible.
Yeah. So, I mean, and when you hear people like a Native American woman comes in, she's been sexually abused by somebody. And so she comes in and I work with her. This is just one case example. First session, she's just absolutely in bliss. I call this my shadow to spirit work. So she comes in with all this shadow trauma, shadow and trauma both. And through the shadow to spirit work, in one session, she's absolutely in bliss. She's just alive and vivacious. She goes out, she comes back. We refine that, go back. After the fifth session, she says, I don't have time for psychotherapy anymore. I'm living such a vivacious life. I don't have time for this anymore. And I'm so grateful that I was sexually abused, because if I hadn't been sexually abused, I wouldn't have met you. I wouldn't have what I have today. Thank you so much. Bye. You know? And boy, when you hear stories like that, it's just like the amount of healing that can be done in such a short amount of time is just, it just brings tears to my eyes. It opens my heart and soul, and it's just beautiful. And by being able to do that kind of work in a short period of time, now you can actually see how we can really start healing trauma and shadow on a massive scale, actually start trying to deal with this. And the more people are healed, the more we won't create all these cultural shadows to create these huge, huge divides between large blocks of people, you know, because then that's the soup that the new generation is raised in, right? And so it just perpetuates it.
Yeah. Now, normally when I hear about these rapid advances in psychotherapy, it is alongside the use of plant spirit medicine or psychedelics. And with your interest in shamanism, I'm wondering if you use any of these or have any experience with any of these.
I do not use them. I've been interested in that a little bit, but I don't tend to use them. I follow the psycho-spiritual path of the natural evolutionary flow of consciousness, just what I kind of see in life. And my concern with using medicinal plants is you don't learn the new process. Something is given to you and it might awaken you, right? I'm not saying that it does or doesn't, I don't know. Mm-hmm. But if I use a material process to get, say, a spiritual awakening or a healing of shadow, I might solve that content. But have I solved the process issue? Mm-hmm. I don't understand the underlying process that led to that. So I might get this beautiful awakening and it might be very good, but I don't know that I learn the skill dynamic underneath it. That being said, I don't judge it either.
You know? Sounds like with the results that you're getting, it's not a necessary.
It's not necessary
tool in your practice.
That's right. It's not a necessary. Results. Yeah, I'm getting the same results or better results in a very short period of time.
So. And I'm glad you brought that up. I think it's a very good point for anyone who is working with psychoactive plant medicine to have that understanding that potentially it is only dealing with the content and not the process. And therefore, and I think a lot of good shamans and spirit workers are aware of that because there's always an integration. Ideally, there's an integration phase afterwards. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I think in that integration is where the process can then be looked at and dealt with and resolved. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm sure they're very good work. You know, everybody's got different categories that they work in. I'm sure there's some very good plant medicine, psychotherapy, shadow work, spiritual work people out there. And it's just not my process, you know,
yeah.
but you need to be able to hold the whole field and see the beauty in that. And I suspect that there are people that are not good that are doing this as well. Right. Just like there are people that are really not good psychotherapists, and there are people that are not good coaches, and there are people that are not good spiritual mentors, you know, they create cults and they abuse people, right? So I think the wise thing to do is whatever method you choose to go with is to really use some critical thinking skills and go, is this a healthy version of this, or is this maybe not a healthy version? What's going on?
Yeah. Well, Kim, this is great. Like, I could literally sit here and probe your mind and experiences for hours because I'm learning so much, being conscientious of the time as well. What is the opportunity for others to work with you and learn from you?
Mm-hmm. So at Stages International, we provide lots of different courses and teachings that you can come in and take the classes. I might be creating a separate website soon, which goes into more processes that are not specifically Stages related that will expand potential teachings that I have that I would like to get out there as well. So that might be coming here in the next few months, just to create a little more expanded repertoire of lessons that can be provided.
Great. And what's the website for Stages?
Stagesinternational.com.
Okay. And is it only evergreen content there, or do you have some live courses and workshops? It sounded like Lonnie Jarrett did a live one with you.
Yeah, there's both. We have some evergreen. We have some live courses. I have meditations that I've done designed for each developmental level. Like a lot of times people get a spiritual meditation, they do it, and then after a while, they're going, I don't do it anymore. I don't have passion for it. And they feel guilty that they're not doing their meditations. And it's like, well, you probably outgrew it, you know, mission accomplished. Good job.
Right.
Okay. Rather than feeling guilty, it's like, that's great. You did it. You're ready just for the next developmental level style of meditation.
That's a different perspective.
Yeah. And so what I do is I have developmental meditations for every developmental level, clear up to the highest levels that we've measured with the Stages model. And so people have taken that course and found incredible aliveness through it. And people have taken my shadow course and gotten aliveness. And some people take both at the same time. And they're saying this is the biggest transformational year they've had in their life. When they take, well, even just the ones that took the shadow said that. But the people that have taken both have just been blown away. It's quite a profound process to work with both shadow and spirit at the same time.
Wow. Do you have any live courses or workshops coming up?
Yeah, we'll have We don't have, we do, yes, they will be probably starting in January, maybe a little earlier. I'll probably start my same, both of those at about the same time where we do the shadow work, live shadow work, and we do the live meditation process. And we'll go through a whole year of transformation with both of them. So you can choose the shadow side, you can choose the spirit side, you can choose to do both at the same time. Mm.
I'm going to follow up with you on that because I'm very intrigued. Okay. Well, this has been great. Thank you so much for enlightening us with all of your experience and your wisdom. This is, it's been fantastic.
Oh, thank you. It's been lovely interacting with you. You're obviously a very bright and heartfelt and deeply exploratory person yourself. And just to have that kind of synergy to work with someone who has that is just really a lovely process. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you so much, Kim, and have a great day.
Okay, you too. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Salish Wolf with Kim Barta. To learn more about Kim and his work, please visit stagesinternational.com. Please also check out anchorpointexpeditions.com for information on my men's leadership retreats, men's groups, and personal development coaching. As British Columbia continues to volley in and out of lockdowns, I don't know when my next leadership retreats will be. In the meantime, however, consider joining the Anchor Point men's group that meets virtually twice every month. This show was produced by me, Todd Howard, on Vancouver Island. Music was written and performed by Jason Kaus of the Darcys. Special thanks to Pacific Rim College for their ongoing contribution to the show. For episodes on holistic health and sustainability, please tune into my other podcast, Pacific Rim College Radio, at pacificrimcollege.com. If you enjoyed this episode, please give it a 5-star rating on whatever podcast app you are using and share it with your friends and family. If there is a guest you would like to recommend for the show, please email discover@anchorpointexpeditions.com. You have been listening to Salish Wolf. I am Todd Howard, signing off.